welcome to this edition of Old School Guns. This is episode 45, one of my favorite numbers. Trump 45, 45 ACP, yeah, 45 Colt, all kinds of good 45s out there. But anyway, episode number 45, and again, we're coming to you. We're on Podbean, iTunes, and probably a few other ones. If you are listening from behind the tofu curtain, which is the West Coast and the liberal Northeast, we definitely welcome you. And we have a bunch of new states that are added to our listenership. Ohio, Illinois, and as far away as Germany, Australia. So that's pretty exciting that people from there are tuning in to what we're saying here in the center of free America, the Midwest of the United States. So it's really awesome to be able to present some of this, and I'll just get right to it. And this is for an area that used to be pretty solid, good gun country, but, you know, has been infiltrated the last few years by some bad people, including a blackface governor, a sexual assaulter lieutenant governor, and God knows what other kind of criminals are in the government and legislature there. And that is Virginia. And yes, Virginia, there is gun control. It's important that if you value your Second Amendment rights in Virginia, get out, vote, organize, get other people to the polls, and be part of the grassroots movement there. And a lot of that, you know, really, this would have gone under the radar if it wasn't for Willis Lee, the second vice president of the NRA, getting onto social media, where he gets a lot of abuse on social media, but he gets out there and puts the word out so that a lot of people can get informed on issues and a lot of the status of how things are going in these special races and who's spending what. You know, Bloomberg has outspent the NRA by about 3-1 in this Virginia election. So it's important to get people out, and Willis Lee is getting people out, and the NRA is doing a great job. They're organizing, they're doing all this. The NRA has really done a great job rebounding from all the turmoil this last summer. As a lot of people, and, you know, I hope it's some of the content creators and some of these other folks who are out there. You know, I don't care what's in Wayne LaPierre's closet. Right now, I don't. You know, we'll deal with that later on down the road. I care about the guns that are in my closet. Can I keep those? Will I have the right to exercise the Second Amendment? And I live in really a great gun-friendly state where I have constitutional carry and a lot of good things. And I hope that this can extend and get into places like Virginia where it can help make a difference the way it has where I live. So, you know, get out, support the NRA. If you're on Facebook, get on there and look up Willis, W-I-L-L-E-S, last name Lee, L-E-E. And he's a great guy. I really like him. He's a retired Army, and he's mission-focused and gets things done. So he's the kind of guy that we need there. And thank goodness we have guys like that. I mean, I feel really, really fortunate that there's leadership out there that gets it done, gets after it and gets it done. And Willis is one of those guys. All right, we got some good news. We can now dance on the grave of Beto O'Rourke's presidential campaign. You know, that was a charade. This guy's a joke. You know, a little preppy, little weirdo. You know, again, he's like Swalwell. You know, the guys look like prep school rejects or something. You know, like the typical punk who would go and, you know, they just fit that profile of the punky frat rat and all that, and it's a really negative stereotype that doesn't really apply to people who do those things, but, you know, they are the stereotype. And you know, so we can now dance on the grave of his presidential campaign, where, you know, he was threatening people, saying, "I'm coming after your AR-15s and your AKs." Well, no, you're not, Beto. You aren't coming after diddly. And, you know, I'll tell you this right now, I'm glad to see it. It's a charade. He was created by the media, who does not like Ted Cruz, and just kind of built him up so that the race was actually closer than it probably should have been in Texas. But this guy's not a national politician. He doesn't have any of the kind of chops, anything to be a serious contender. And now he's gone. And you know, finally, the one thing you can say is at least the monetary part of the system worked. His money dried up and he's gone. And, you know, but he did do us a favor. He tipped the hat to what their agenda is. 100% confiscation. So, you know, Beto spilled the beans. And that's what's going on with all that. He basically spilled it, and now we know what they're after, and you see a lot of mobilization against it. His statements have helped galvanize the gun rights movement and have really put a lot of energy into it. People want to defend themselves, and we're at the point where we can defend ourselves, we want to defend ourselves, and we have the right to defend ourselves. We just have to stand up for those rights. So I'm glad Beto is gone, and I'm glad that there's some energy back into the gun rights movement. Hey, I don't know if you've been looking at the news lately, but there's been a spate in Denver and in Houston and probably some other places. Just a spate of armored car robberies. You know, something that really don't see strong-armed robberies of these, you know, kind of Brinks truck armored car things. Really very unusual. They caught them on tape. I was watching some this morning, and very dangerous situation. Very, very dangerous. The only advice I will give people is I don't know that this is going to be that widespread. There are probably thousands of pickups made every single day. So, you know, two or three or four robberies, you know, it's not really much of a chance that you would run across that. But, you know, one of the things I always do is when I see an armored car is I give it a wide berth. You know, when I see those guys, they're parked and they're probably moving money in and out. I don't looky-loo. I don't stick around to see how these guys operate or what the deal is. You know, I park somewhere else. I make sure I go in another door. I stay away from all that. And that's really good advice, you know, if these robberies kind of pick up and continue. I mean, you don't want to be where the action is. As an armed citizen or a citizen, you don't want to be where the action is, because nothing good will happen to you. Nothing good will happen to you at all. And the guys doing these robberies look to me like they're wearing ballistic helmets, masks, body armor. You know, you hate to say it, but they almost look like cops. And, you know, yeah, it's pretty easy when, you know, when you're sitting at your living room or your breakfast table looking at the video, understanding who are the good guys and who are the bad guys. But if you're kind of in the middle of it, it's going to be very difficult to see. You're not going to know who's who. You don't have time to sit there and figure out whose side everybody on. This is not a shirt and skins deal here. They're all wearing kind of the same clothes. And, you know, I know that the police usually, whatever agency, usually it says police or it'll say FBI or DEA or something else on it. But you never really, you know, I mean, those things could probably be fake too. I mean, so I would stay away. You do not want to get mixed up in something like that. The other deal is these robbers are apparently very well armed and very organized. I mean, what I saw was not amateur hour. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't some sort of goofy deal or whatever. They knew exactly how those trucks operated. They knew exactly the right moment to strike. They were in and out with the money very quickly. Now, whether they ultimately get away with it or not is something else. But at least, you know, they had what you could consider the tactical victory. I mean, they got in there, did it, and got out. And, you know, anybody who's in their way is going to get taken out. Apparently in Houston, one of the drivers, I guess, had some kind of resistance or there was some sort of a deal, and he was shot right out of hand. So, you know, if you're in the way or you try to intercede or try to interfere on any level or just get caught in the wrong place at the wrong time, you're in the way of their egress route, their escape route, they're going to take you right out, especially if you look like you're going to offer them any kind of problem. And so basically what I would do is, you know, if you're going to whatever business and you see the armored car there, I would be elsewhere. I would either come back later, which is the best idea, or make sure that I park, use a different entrance, and stay away, because those things are now targets. They're now targets, And although it's very, very, very rare that something would happen, the chance is still there. Of course, I tend to think, what could the good guys do to counterbalance this? And you almost think that starting a small company, if you're in a high-risk area or near a high-risk area, here we're near Kansas City, which can be a very high-risk area depending on the part of town. It'd be really cool to put together a crew of about 6 or 8 guys and basically be a vendor to these companies saying, hey, we can protect you in high-risk areas. Get a couple of, say, 2 up-armored SUVs and basically be, guarding or escorting the high-risk shipments. So, there could be a deal there. And, it's only a matter of time before somebody figures out that, they all wear dark clothing. And it's only a matter of time before somebody figures out if these guys are using optics, red dots, and even my favorite, the EOTech, which I'll talk about later, and some of these other ones. It's only a matter of time before somebody develops what will be optical camouflage clothing. And I mean that is, I've never taken a red dot out and put it up against an orange vest. So rather than wearing the dark clothes where the orange dot or the reticle stands out very, very clearly, maybe if you're wearing some sort of orange or neon clothing, maybe, or there's some kind of clothing you can wear where that disappears. In an urban environment, that might be something that is all of a sudden another variable thrown into the mix. I don't really know what those things are going to look like on an orange vest. Is it going to be like dark iron sights against a dark background and you just lose the front sight? And even the rear sight is hard to see against that black background, which is why I assume they kind of wear that, plus they think it looks bad, looks super cool or whatever. But if you put, as a matter of fact, one of the old school things we had at the beginning of the War on Terror before red dots and EOTechs were all over the place, is it takes some testers red paint, and you'd paint your front sight post red. And you did that because it would stand out against, especially if it's kind of lower light, in the absolute dark it won't help, but in lower light, when you're shooting at a dark figure and you've got dark iron sights, hey man, you might not have the iron sights, you might just be instinct shooting. Whereas if you can pick up your front sight, your eye will kind of center it in the rear, and you've got a much higher hit probability if you can see that front sight. So perhaps, this is an old concept. The military had actually promethium sights back in the probably the late 60s, early 70s for the M16. Never really saw them. They were gone by the time I was in. But oddly enough, the front sights were gone. The front sight had a little promethium thing in there, and it would glow, kind of glow in the dark sight. And the rear sights, though, had a larger aperture ring. Still found M16s that had the rear sight with the large ring, but the front sight had been replaced and swapped out. And I only assume that somebody was too lazy to take the rear off. They just basically swapped out the front and said, hey, good to go. And then the new guy in the unit gets issued the rifle. And some people don't even know the difference. So I assume that's why I saw that. But this is an old deal of, can you make your front sight stand out in front of on a dark background? And now we're going to hit the inverse, where can you make a red dot disappear? And is there a background that'll do that? That'll be an interesting thing to see. But there's money. There's going to be money to be made with high risk transports. Putting together a good crew, some ex-military guys that kind of know what's going on. You select the right guys. It'd be interesting to see if these robberies continue. I'm sure there will be some sort of additional security, additional stuff going on, and that's probably what it's going to look like right there. I would assume that the next time you see a few armored cars, especially in a high-risk area, or if they're transporting something very high-risk, you'll probably see some SUVs accompanying it, and inside that will be some very well-armed and some former special operations and perhaps some special law enforcement, retired law enforcement operators that are making some money on the outside. And so I would not be surprised to see that. Okay, I want to get into some of the usual jackassery that happens. And again, this is, I tell you, I can make a living off these guys. The latest InRange Q&A, which just has this Carl Carsada himself on there. Usually it's both of them. And you know, a lot of times they're not bad. I enjoy watching them. I think they turn out some very good content sometimes. What I really like about InRange TV is it can turn out very interesting content on testing certain things. Now, their mud tests are all anecdotal, but as I've said before, if Colt had done that in the 70s, they would have sold a lot more AR-15s than they did. And they would have sold a lot more of them, that's for sure. And they'd be king of the hill today. They literally would have a money machine. They'd be making more money than drug dealers. I mean, they would be selling massive amounts of AR-15s. They wouldn't be getting out of the market because it's saturated. They would be owning the market. But that's another story. The other stuff they do, they've done some, you know, some of these armor tests are interesting. And you know, body armor, they test the body armor against various calibers. I like that. The historical ones are, you know, they're okay. They if you're in the right mood, you can watch that. So they have a variety of programming. Some of it's very good. I enjoy. I really enjoy when, I used to enjoy, and they don't do it much anymore, when the two primaries, Carl and Ian, would go to a match, and they would kind of use some vintage equipment and things. That's kind of up my alley and up my interest. And I really kind of enjoyed that. And I actually enjoyed, even though they're not military guys, you know, kind of their critiques of saying, well, you know, I used this, I thought this was going to go one way, but it actually went another. And so I think that was all very interesting, and I enjoyed that very much. But on this latest Q&A, they go back to what I consider to be reinforcing a really bad myth. And that bad myth is simply this. They talk about the M1 carbine being unreliable. I mean, they talk about it. They'll openly discuss it. And they basically, their theory is no M1 carbine is reliable. And they base this on, he bases this on, I assume, two-gun match experience and, you know, his own personal dealings with them. And frankly, it's not that I find them hard to believe, it's just that I find them hard to believe. Here's my own experience, and I will kind of lay this all out so that people can kind of make a decision on their own. My first thing is that when you talk about a rifle's reliability, especially a semi-automatic military style, modern-ish rifle, anything from World War II on, you're really talking about ammunition, magazines, and then the system that's designed to fire the cartridge. The other issue is reliability is it's not a really well-defined term. Are we talking 100% reliability, that there's never a problem, that it always fires? And no gun can live up to that. Not a single one can live up to that. Even the AK-47 cannot live up to that. Even the Glock cannot live up to that. So when we talk about reliability, I think when we talk about that those components are, those three variables are good, that the rifle functions the way it's supposed to. And that's basically taking things that can make a reliable system unreliable off the table. We're talking about hand loads. We're talking about USA magazines. My Ruger Mini 14, completely reliable with Ruger magazines and some aftermarket magazines. But there are other aftermarket magazines that are trash, and it's unreliable with them because they're not manufactured correctly. So therefore, one of the variables is out of whack, and it wrecks the whole system. The system does not function. To judge the Mini 14 on that would be unfair. If you use Ruger magazines and you use factory loaded ammunition, it works just fine. I've never had a problem with it. Never had a problem with the operating system. The InRange TV position is that it's an underpowered cartridge. It has an exposed action, and the gas system is not one that really enhances the reliability. Okay. So that's their deal. And they've never gotten it to work and yada, 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 yada. Well, I've had three M1 carbines over the years. And currently I have one. My stepson has one. And then I had one before, which I sold to finance something else. And they were all dead on reliable. And I mean, they're just dead on. The only reliability issue I've ever had was with a single 30-round magazine that had a weak spring, and therefore it would not function. Basically, the bolt would override the round. It just didn't have enough strength to push the round up quickly enough to get it to chamber. With other magazines, that problem went away. I even have mine as very reliable with hand-loaded ammunition. I've even used lead bullets, and I've used the Spear plinkers, and I'm able to, you know, as long as you've got the powder charge and it's powerful enough and you go by any of the standard published data for those kind of bullets, they work. They work well. They work well. So when I can get by even by tweaking and fumbling around with the one variable ammunition, if it's still reliable, I think it's got to be a pretty good system. And you know what? Lo and behold, it is. The M1 carbine works. Now, if they can't get it to work in their two-gun match, I'm sorry about that. There were 9 million made during World War II. I mean, it's one of those weapons that was very simple to manufacture, and they came off the assembly line in SCADs. After the war, they had been given out as foreign military aid to practically any friendly government that would take them. They were used up through the end of the Vietnam War in large numbers, and I'm sure they're still being used somewhere today. I know that the last use I know of them was, I think Israel still used some for bus guards, and you know, it's really kind of almost militia-type weapons. I have seen them in service. Of course, it makes you feel ancient to say something like that, but in 1984-85, we used to have Reforger, and Reforger was return of forces to Germany, happened during the winter, and I remember sitting in a frigid tent at Schiphol Airport in the Netherlands, and some Dutch reservists who were securing the site. These were Dutch reserve troops. One of them was armed with an M1 Garand rifle, and another one with an M1 carbine. So even into the 1980s, you're going to see these weapons, and especially the M1 carbine, still in use. If it was an inherently unreliable weapon, that would not happen. We did have some inherently unreliable weapons in World War II. The most notable one that jumps to mind was the Riesing submachine gun. The Riesing worked just fine in trials and in very clean environments, but in the jungle environment of Guadalcanal, where there was a lot more crud, a lot more debris, and the weapon was got a lot dirtier, it was found unreliable. And frankly, it was shown the door by the U.S. military. It was gone in a very short period of time. Had the carbine been the same way, if it had been inherently unreliable, it would have been gone. They would have shut down production. They would have used it for training or some sort of stateside, you know, BS guard duty of defense plants or something, which is eventually what happened to the Riesing. They would have just used it for that. They would have shut it down, and they would have gone and looked for some other, another solution that was more suitable. But they did not. They stuck with the M1 carbine. In fact, they expanded production. There has to be 6 or 8 manufacturers of these things, and it's a lot of companies that were not gun companies, thinking of Inland, General Motors, and Underwood Typewriter, Rockola Jukeboxes, you know. Companies that had never made firearms before or since were able to turn out quality M1 carbines. Now, the ones we have on the market today that are newly manufactured, and there's a company called Inland, no relation to the original, and there's Auto Ordnance and all. I can't speak to those. I have not tested those personally. I would, and I will test them if the opportunity presents itself, but the fact of the matter is I'm talking about the USGI guns, which is what they were talking about on InRange TV. So they say it's unreliable. I call bullshit. And that's just the way it is. If you do have an M1 carbine that you're having issues with, I would say the first thing to check is make sure you got the right kind of ammunition. Don't If it's not working with your hand loads, don't blame the rifle. Use some different ammunition. And there's a variety of ammunition out there. There's even some steel-cased stuff out there. I've not had a problem with it, but, you know, I can't speak for every rifle out there. So change ammunition. Check your magazines. I have found that the 15-round USGI magazines are wonderful. They work great. There are aftermarket 30-rounders, which I'm a little more skeptical of. But really, outside of one magazine that I talked about earlier, I have not had a problem. So, you know, go ahead and realize. The other thing is, make sure your gun's broken in. There are a lot of people who, you know, when they're breaking in a gun, they say, well, it's not reliable, and they give up on it. Now, sometimes guns have to be fired a couple hundred times to really get it. Make sure that you're lubricating them, doing all the right things. And I think you'll find that the M1 carbine is an ace of a weapon. And when it comes to the U.S. military, the only criticism of it was that it was underpowered, especially compared to the M1 rifle. While it was quick firing, very handy and everything else, had a lot of attributes and a lot of people liked it, it was underpowered. And that was much more of a consideration in the Korean War, where the ranges could be greater. You know, they were fighting from hilltop to hilltop. And I've heard anecdotally that, of course, in the wintertime when people are wearing a lot more clothes, I'm sure that its ballistic effect on a human target was not as great because it had to pass through some layers of stuff. So that, you know, that could be true. I remain dubious, but I think maybe that, coupled with longer ranges, made it seem less effective. But the M1 carbine worked well, and everybody who's used one that I've know of has liked it. And frankly, I know a lot of people who use M1 carbines, and they're very reliable. We were just in a match. He talks about his two-gun match. We were just in a match where we basically held what was kind of a mad minute. And at the range of 40 yards, we basically took 3 minutes and, you know, fire as much as you want from 1945 and pre-weapons, semi-automatic weapons. And I used a 1927 Thompson, and the guy who really shot the most, and our deal was to see who could shoot the most rounds off. This is just kind of fun after a vintage rifle match. And so we went over, we did this, and it was great. It was great fun. The guy who basically fired the most had an M1 carbine, and it went through in, you know, just under 3 minutes. He went through 158 rounds. No stoppages, nothing. It just cranked. And there was actually another M1 carbine on the range, too, and it did similar, you know, almost as much. A lot of fun. With my semi-automatic Thompson, I couldn't keep up with it, but we were all having fun. We did any position, so the carbine shooters were prone. I was actually doing the standing position. We were just all having fun. And there was a whole variety of things out there, a couple other semi-automatic Thompsons and a few other things. So, you know, I just sat there and said, hey, you know, and at 40 yards, of course, an M1 carbine groups very, very well. I mean, it does very, very well, even when you're shooting it, quote, as fast as you can. Even today, the M1 carbine is a great PDW, personal defense weapon. You know, everybody likes these small personal defense weapons, like the, you know, FN makes one, and everybody makes it. Well, I'm telling you, the M1 carbine is still out there. You replace the front handguard with one that's got, you know, the rail that everybody has to have. You can put an optic on it, and hey, you're in business. You've updated from 1945 to 2019 pretty quick. Put the optic of your choice on there, and there you go. You know, it's a good little rifle, and it does not deserve to be dogged out by InRange TV, who just, for some reason, they've had a bad experience with them. And they don't have the experience to make it shoot right. These are the same guys who can't shoot FNFALs. You know, they, you know, you've seen the videos, I've discussed them. So, you know, their weapons handling skills are poor, and some of their opinions derived from such are very poor also. So that's my deal. The M1 carbine is reliable in spite of what InRange TV says, and it is a good weapon. And the only thing that you can say, as I said before, is okay, it's underpowered, but it was designed to be underpowered. They also stated that, well, it was really only good for, truck drivers and other people replace a pistol. That was the original intent. It wound up being used by NCOs, officers, and all kinds of other people who were actually in frontline combat because they needed a lighter, more agile weapons because they were doing maybe a variety of tasks other than being a rifleman or a machine gunner. So the M1 carbine was a very convenient weapon to do that. It's kind of like the Sherman tank. The Sherman tank had, it was good at a lot of things, wasn't really great at any one thing. Well, the M1 carbine was kind of the same thing. It could do, fulfill a variety of roles well, but was it the optimal weapon to have? Well, probably not for any one of those things. But when you're fighting a world war and you've got to supply armies that are fighting in Europe, fighting in the Pacific, and all the other kind of environs, everything from Arctic to jungle to desert, M1 carbine worked out very, very well. It worked out very, very well. Okay, I'd like to now talk about, I mentioned them earlier, and it's a company that I really think puts out an excellent product and does a great job. Brownells is one of them, and another one is EOTech. I think EOTech sights are probably the best sights on the market today for, non-specific AR type rifles. If your AR rifle is designed for personal protection and, kind of going out and casual shooting and all these other things, EOTech is an absolute great sight. Even for certain competitions, I think it's still a great sight. Since it's a non-magnified optic, of course, if you want to shoot at longer distances, for ARs that are designed to shoot at longer distances, it is not a good choice. But for every other AR, your M4 copies and all this, it's really a great sight. They're rugged, they're reliable, they give, they have a 68 mil circle, which is a big circle, which up close, that's perfect. You can see that and just lay it on the target up close, and there you are. Then there's also a 1 MOA dot in the center of that. And it's not difficult to hit 200-yard targets with using that. It's not difficult at all. And given, if you, especially if you zero your weapon right, you can get a really good put. You put a 200-yard zero on it, you're really going to be effective out to 200 yards. And it's a quick sight. It's really well made, very durable. What I like, the ones I like are the ones that take the AA batteries. And I know that's not very high speed compared to, those are kind of the, I've got one sight. It's the 552. This sight went overseas, went into the sandbox. It was never US government property. It was personal property, came home. So I have it. It's mine. I've always had it, used it. It's an excellent piece of equipment. I don't really use the night vision portion of it. So the equivalent that most people should buy would be the 512, unless you have some, unless you're a police guy or you have some sort of night vision use. The 512 is the same thing without the night vision capability. Exactly the same, really. I really like the AA batteries. I use lithium batteries in it. They last a long time. They basically, they're very, very good, easy to swap out. You can get them anywhere. But even the crappy, even if you got stuck, and let's say you are near Walmart and all you can get is the crappy 30 battery pack of Rayovacs or whatever the cheapest battery on the market is, even the cheapest AA's will run the thing for a sufficiently long period of time. And then, like I said, if you buy the Walmart 30 pack, you just, when it starts blinking, when the reticle starts blinking, you have about 20% of your battery left, and that's a good time to swap them out. So you basically can get rid of them and put in the other two more of the crappy batteries and go. But the lithium batteries really really work out very, very well. Excellent. I just find that it co-witnesses nicely. Everything about it is is really good. I've got a you know, just inexpensive Magpul pop-up rear sight. So just in case it ever goes out when I really need to use to hit something precisely, I've got this nice pop-up sight, and it works. It all works very nicely on top of an AR-15. But EOTech really is a good company. They stand behind what they sell, and they do produce a superior product. I mean, I've used some of the aim points going way back too. I've got an aim point 3, which you have to Google to see. It's like a super primitive aim point. And in fact, the three power magnifier actually is really thin. It looks like one of those cheap 22 scopes that they used to sell, and it actually screws into the back of the aim point. And you know, it is what it is, and it was what it was. Very, very good sight back in the late 70s, early 80s. And I think it's really a pretty good sight today, actually. You could still use it on, you know, if you had a 10/22 or maybe even a Ruger PC9 that you just wanted to put an inexpensive sight on that's an aim point. They do kind of, some of them kind of take some funky batteries and all the rest. You know, all the things that they've corrected in the later iterations, you know, the funky batteries and battery life and all that. Those are still problems, obviously, with the early sights. But I find the EOTech to be the best, just the best sight going. So it's the best one. And once you use one, I swear, you swear by it. You absolutely will swear by it. And so I would say that they are a great company to do business with. They stand behind their products, and they produce something that is really world class, really excellent. So one of the other things I wanted to kind of get to today is bank safety deposit boxes. And bank safety deposit boxes are one of those things that people think they understand, but they really don't. And how many times have you ever heard a guy say, "Well, I got a gun that's so valuable, I put it in a safety deposit box." Well, a safety deposit box isn't as safe as you think it is, for a variety of reasons. I'll go through the first one is, number one, it's going to cost you about $25 a month to rent one of those things. So, you know, you times that all out. So you have to have something pretty valuable in there to realize that storing it in the what you think is the secure environment of the bank is a big deal. So, you know, whatever that comes out to a year, 12 times 25, a couple $100 a year, $300, $400, whatever that is. So what do you actually get for that? What you actually get is a place inside a bank vault where, you know, your valuable property, your valuable gun is locked inside. And, you know, somebody would have to literally steal the vault or get in there and open all of them to get at your stuff. So it's a very secure place in some ways. The physical security of it is very strong, you know, just the locks and the barriers and the alarms, all that is very, very strong. So that is an advantage, and that's a good thing. The reason it's really bad is there have been some very, very bad things that have happened. And one of them that most people don't know is that the stuff you put in a safety deposit box is not insured. So if it winds up missing or it winds up damaged, you're out. You're the insurer, you're out. So if it's a very, very valuable item, a very valuable, let's say it's a firearm, let's say it's a Custer era single action, okay, and it's worth $75,000, you put it in a safety deposit box. Well, if you go back a year, 2 years, or 5 years later and open it up, and there's nothing but a bunch of rust inside, this thing's crusted in rust now, because there's really no guarantee that there's climate control inside there. You know, hey, it's on you. Or if you didn't oil it very well before you put it in and you had fingerprints on it, and now those fingerprints are now etched into the very valuable gun you had, hey, that's on you. There's no insurance that's going to go. Now, if somebody gets in there and takes it for however reason, that's very rare, but it can happen. It can't happen. What if some unauthorized family member kind of gets in there, or somebody you had on it, and then, you know, all that. Once it's gone, it's no longer, it's not the bank's problem. you know, it's gone. The other thing that can happen is, and this is some very bad stuff, is that, hey, if you don't pay your rent on the box because you forget, or let's just say that, you know, something happens, you get, you're in the hospital and you're on disability or whatever, and hey, you don't, the last thing you're thinking about is this payment that you've made every month, and it normally came out of your debit card, but your debit card changed, so now it doesn't come out anymore and you really don't miss it. And you're really not getting the notices because you're on disability or whatever. Somebody else is kind of handling that. Guess what? Just like those storage lockers you see on TV, the bank will take these safety deposit boxes that are in arrears and they will sell them. You know, they auction them off, just like on Storage Wars, where, you know, those kind of weird people who go from one place to another, you know, they bid on those. They bid on those lockers, and you know what's ever in there belongs to them. So, effectively, for non-payment of the rent on the box, the stuff inside, and it doesn't matter if it's $1 million worth of stuff, or if it's just your passport and a few papers, that stuff effectively now belongs to the bank, and they auction it off, and then it's no longer yours. You can't get it back. So your prized guns that you've put in there, maybe two or three handguns or whatever else, they now belong to somebody else and you can't get them back. And there's no insurance that covers that. It's on you. You insure it. Now, this could happen very badly if they make a mistake. And what if they auction your box, even if you've paid the rent? Guess what? It's still on you. It's, you know, you would be in a legal battle and you might get some... relief on that, but you know it's not as safe as you think it is. So when you're weighing the options between a safety deposit box and a large, nice home gun safe, you know you better think long and hard about which one you choose. There's risk both ways, but just like a storage unit, hey, you know I'm not going to put some good stuff. You know where, hey, if there's a mess up with the invoicing or somehow, you know, I'm incapacitated and I don't make the payments or whatever, all the stuff I got in there, they can sell because now it effectively belongs to them. I don't really think that's a very secure place at all. And the bank can do that, and the bank has, banks have done that. So the other thing about it is you're not going to enjoy it. I could go into some stories. I know one story about there were some historical artifacts, including a couple guns that were in a bank for over 50 years. Now, just thinking about the box rent alone, you have to kind of put that against the value of the items. But you know, you're going against that, and all of a sudden, you open it up in there, and these things hadn't been looked at in years and years. Fortunately, the guns did not, they did not rust, and they weren't degraded by that storage, but nobody looked at them in 50 years. So these guns that everybody thought were very, very valuable turned out to be not so valuable. One of them was a Colt 1908 380 pocket hammerless, and the frame had, you know, a serious impact on it, and actually the frame was actually bent. I mean, the gun effectively has no collector, and really it would probably still function because it was, the dust cover was kind of, you know, on the bottom of the slide was bent out, but you know, it a gunsmith would have to be very careful and have to repair that. You know, it was a seriously damaged gun. The gun has very little value on the market. I mean, I would probably say that it was not even worth 1 year of rent on the box. Another one was a Colt single action second generation parts gun, which has some value, but some of the original parts were not there. The most notoriously, the grip frame had been swapped out for something else. And then the third one was an early 32 Colt Pocket 1903, which is a nice gun and has value to it. But again, did it justify 50 years of rent in a in a safety deposit box? You know, I personally don't think so. The bank actually went out of business and told the people, "Hey, get your stuff out of these boxes." And you know, that's another thing. A branch goes out of business or it moves, and if they can't contact everybody to get the stuff out, they sell the boxes. They sell those. You know, I mean, you know, it is a terrible type of situation. I don't trust safety deposit boxes. I used to when I was growing up. That was the gold standard. Man, if you have something valuable, you put it in a safety deposit box, nobody's going to get it. But nowadays, you find out that it's really not as secure a storage method as everyone would have thought and as everyone would like it to be, especially when it comes to firearms and precious things like that. Okay, we'll get to my favorite part of the podcast here, which is questions and answers. And I got a question that was related to, again, the in-range question and answer. So I'll go ahead and put this at number one to be answered. Is the 1911 A1 obsolete? And we're talking predominantly about Colt 1911 style handguns. They come in a variety of calibers. I mean, you can get them in a variety of calibers, but the predominant one is 45 ACP, but you can get them in 38 Super, even 9mm, and I think they've actually even made 10mm. There's probably one out there in 40 Smith & Wesson somewhere. You know, so it comes in all the popular auto pistol calibers. And I think that it's a very interesting question, because normally the 1911 and the 45 ACP are just intertwined. You're really talking the same thing. As a matter of fact, when I was a kid and you talked about a 45 automatic, you talked about a 1911 because there wasn't really anything else. That was it. And even today, even somebody says, "I got a 45 automatic," my mind goes to 1911, although clearly there are other possibilities. But I'll go and start first with, you know, is the 1911 obsolete? No, because it depends on what you are using it for. And it also depends on what your basic beliefs are. If you believe that the 45 ACP is obsolete and that single stack magazines are effectively obsolete, then yes, the original pattern 1911 A1s are obsolete. If you believe single action autos are obsolete, then the 1911 pattern autos are obsolete, even the ones that have the double stack magazines that came in later. You know, if you believe those things are all obsolete, then yes, it's obsolete. If you believe that the 45 caliber pistol cartridge has advantages over the 9mm, if you believe that the excellent ergonomics of the 1911 are something that are never obsolete, and if you believe that a single action auto like the 1911, which has a hammer safety, a grip safety, and a thumb safety, and in later models, the Series 80, an enhanced thumb safety, if you believe that that is safe and you want to carry it cocked and locked, as we used to call it, and I believe they still call it that today, then I would say no, it's not obsolete. There's very few. In the real world, there's very few situations that cannot be handled by a 1911 pistol in 45 caliber. For police officers who are using it as a primary weapon and may come against some heavily armed assailants, I can understand why somebody would say, well, the high-capacity 9mm is clearly a better choice. So I look upon it this way. It depends on your intended purpose, whether something is obsolete, obsolescent, or is up to date. Now, when it comes to these gamers, and the in-range TV guys are gamers, they like to pretend they're tactical or they have some experience, but they don't. The fact of the matter is, anything that's not a game cartridge or game setup gun really doesn't have any value to them. So the 9mm is perfect. It's high capacity. The ammo is cheap. It makes a hole in their paper target or rings the gong. So it's fine. They're fine with it. So it's like anything else. I don't accept their word except in their area of experience and expertise, and that is gaming. And in gaming, yes, the 45 ACP, unless it's in its own special kind of class, it is not the optimal gun to use. For a person looking for home defense or a sidearm in addition to another long arm, then you have a very, very good pistol that's capable of handling things. My thing on the caliber debate is you can always hope that a 9mm will expand, and in many cases they do, but a 45 will never shrink. So that's kind of how the way I come down on that. Okay, next question. Dinosaurs and guns. And this is not what you think it is. It was an article, and I don't know exactly when it was written. It pops up on Facebook occasionally in the revolver groups. There are a few gun groups that are allowed to exist on Facebook after you swear allegiance that you won't try to buy anything, won't try to sell anything, and et cetera, et cetera. But this was written by Venturino, the prolific gun writer. And it was just basically talking about how good a lot of the old revolvers are. Things like the 1917, he mentioned quite a bit. And that's a great revolver. I mean, an absolutely great revolver. And in fact, Smith & Wesson has made some later runs of them, even up until fairly recently. And there have always been, the 625 and the Model 25. There's always been some 45 ACP slash auto rim handguns out there. And why these things will never really win matches for you or anything else. They're super accurate and they're really good guns to have. The thing about a Smith & Wesson end frame in 45 caliber that has always amazed me is the gun is really light and well balanced, even though it is a very large gun. When an end frame is in 38 or 357, you really notice the weight, the extra metal in the barrel and the extra metal in between the chambers of the cylinder really add a lot of weight to it. So I really like the 45 caliber guns. They are really nice, well balanced, easy to use. They're really great. But anyway, this was a great article. It's a lot of fun. I think if you look up dinosaurs and guns, it probably Google that, you'll probably pull this thing up. But it just goes to show you that not everything has to be the latest and greatest, and not everyone has to have the latest plasti gun 9mm. To go back to the previous question, obsolete or obsolescent? I don't really think so. I don't really think so at all. Not if you need accuracy, not if you need power, not if you need what a 45 caliber projectile can give you. And plus, they're just darn handy. Darn good trail guns, very versatile, really nice. So I would commend that article to anybody. Go ahead and read it, see what you think. And you can always email me or leave a comment and let me know. Okay, here's a great one. Do you follow any of the zombie TV shows or zombie movies? And what do you think of zombie-inspired shooting gear? Well, that's a two-parter. First of all, I really don't follow any of that. I watched Night of the Living Dead years ago, and I've seen a few of the kind of zombie-inspired movies over the years. I think that, the original idea has kind of been done enough times so that I don't watch the latest TV shows and all that. It is what it is. It's entertainment. It's just like Dirty Harry movies or whatever else. It's entertainment, so it's pretty good. I thought the zombie shooting gear was a weird phenomenon, and the reason I didn't really care for it was, although it was made kind of tongue in cheek, it kind of wasn't serious enough. Shooting is kind of a serious sport because of the safety concerns. And some of this stuff, when they had to put warnings on boxes of their zombie ammo, hey, this is real ammo, this is not play stuff and all that. I think then they should have looked and said, hey, maybe this isn't a great marketing thing or whatever. And it was a fad for a really short period of time. And I mean, I think even EOTech came out with a zombie sight. And I mean, I remember seeing a couple four-wheel drives painted with zombie response vehicle and all the rest of this. So I just kind of see it as good fun. I didn't really like the zombie gear. As a matter of fact, 6 or 8 months after that stuff was introduced, I remember seeing it. They were selling it as cheap as they could to get rid of it. You know, it really wasn't the marketing bonanza they thought it was going to be. So all that kind of stuff, yeah, it's silly. And, you know, as long as people don't take it seriously, it's fine. But I personally had no use for it. I thought it was just too gimmicky and really too silly. So that's how I did it. And no, I don't follow any of the shows or the movie franchises at all. Okay, what would you consider the ultimate test for a rifleman and a handgunner? What would I consider the ultimate test for a rifleman? Now that's interesting, and I don't know that I have a good answer to that. That is, I suppose a rifleman should be able to hit his intended target from any shooting position at reasonable ranges. The easy cop-out would be to say, hey, extended long range where guys are shooting at 2,000 plus yards, that's the ultimate test. But a lot of time, those guys have a lot of rests and everything and a lot of mechanical devices to keep the... And they have genetically engineered cartridges and optics and enhancements and specially built rifles for that task. So I don't know. When I tend to think of a rifleman, I tend to think of somebody who's armed with a rifle for a practical purpose and not really something like a bench rest shooter. I'm not disparaging bench rest shooting, but I just don't think it fits in there. That's its own specific sport, just like extended long range and something else. So I would say being able to hit and know your point of aim, know your point of impact, and being able to hit targets at suitable ranges. I think that's the ultimate test of a rifleman. I do think that you're wasting any rifle that's shot at 100 yards is essentially being wasted. And this goes back to something that we talked about in an earlier podcast of everybody in the world claims their rifle shoots. Mine shoots MOA. Mine shoots minute of angle groups. And then you find out they're shooting at 100 yards, where most rifles, especially fired from a bench, and many rifles will shoot minute groups at least part of the time from the bench. And it's hunting rifles, it's target rifles, and probably even some lever-action rifles will do that. We'll shoot very good groups from a bench at 100 yards. When you get out beyond 100 yards, then things like trigger pull and a few other things come into play, one of them being sights and the consistent sight picture. Those come into play, and sometimes that can cause groups to open up, as can ammunition choice, because certain ammunition is designed for terminal performance on game and not necessarily shooting tight groups at 200 and 300 yards. I look at it this way. I test rifles at 300 yards, and depending on the use and type of the rifle, the accuracy standards can change. A bolt action heavy barrel and 6.5 Creedmoor with a very expensive scope sight is going to have a different measure of performance than, say, an open sight FN, FAL. Just will, because they're two different things. They're designed for two different purposes. But testing them at that range gives you a really good indication of what it is. There's also another thing that always gets me is there's really no standard way to measure group size. You watch YouTube videos, everybody does it a bit differently. So therefore, the claims people make are the claims people make. Some people include flyers, even if it's a called flyer, and some people don't. They'll say, well, that was a flyer, that doesn't really count. Here's the other three shots I fired, that's the group. You know, you can just go round and round and round with all this. That's why I believe if you can hit your point of aim, if your point of impact matches your point of aim, and you're able to hit and neutralize your target, there you go. That's a great test for a rifleman. And it's not necessarily done with scoring rings. Maybe it's done with just a solid black 18-inch circle that's filled in, a big black dot. Maybe you hit that. Maybe it's a gong, steel gongs or steel half silhouettes, a different deal. That's kind of my deal. I know that traditional target shooting is all about scoring rings and the almighty X-ring, and I do some of that myself, but I don't really feel those are the ultimate test of a rifleman. A lot of times it's how quickly can you engage a target. There's a lot of different shooting disciplines that, for rifles especially, that challenge that. Same thing with handguns. I'm not going to take a 9mm Glock after bears. I mean, I'm just not. So, different guns have different standards. I would say that in general, I would say that if you a good test for a handgunner is can you handle the recoil of your chosen firearm without developing bad habits and staying on target consistently shot after shot. And that's a lot easier to do with a 22 target 22 than it is with a 44 Magnum and bigger. So, so those are good tests. I think maybe a great test of a rifleman and a great test of a handgunner is being able to teach less experienced and younger shooters, teaching them essential skills to help them improve. Maybe that is actually the ultimate test. I don't know. I think so. That's definitely a great thing to be doing is teaching a younger person how to shoot and helping them, get into what I think is one of the greatest hobbies going, which is shooting. Well, that's it for another edition of Old School Guns. And as always, please hit the like, follow, or whatever button you can, and stay tuned for our next podcast. And until then, this is Old School Guns out.